Good morning to everyone. Thank you for getting up to come to my talk this morning. As Sandy said, I'm Tara Whalen. I'm an IT research analyst at the Office of the Privacy Commissioner of Canada, and I am thrilled and honored to be addressing you this morning. I'm going to explain the title. I don't know how many people in the audience are not American, like me, who may not know where the quote comes from, but we're going back to Reagan here, who is saying that the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Now, as it happens, I hope you aren't scared that I actually am from the government, and I believe that I am here to help in some ways, both as a civil servant and as a technologist. But I'll try not to scare you too much throughout the talk. So I need something to balance out Reagan, and I have some Ionesco, who we hope will balance us out. He says a civil servant doesn't make jokes, but and I'm not a real civil servant because there may be some jokes throughout to keep you awake this morning. There will be no test afterward, thankfully. Well, it's absurdist. Maybe we'll have a strange test. So to give you an idea of how I wound up where I am and the kind of roles I have and the hats I have to wear, I'll give you a little bit of a synopsis of my professional career. I really trained as a computer scientist. I have a little bit of philosophy in there, which has been remarkably useful in my current job. I spent some time as a software developer, then mostly spent time as a privacy and security researcher, a lot of networks, a lot of usable security, some time in academia, which is a link that I've kept, and now mostly being a Canadian civil servant. And these roles often intersect in my daily work. They interact. They mostly don't interfere, but it can be interesting trying to juggle all of these different roles. And so I'll be talking a lot today about, in a way, the interdisciplinary nature of being a technologist in a civil service role. But before all of that, we're going to start with a joke. Well, not really. More an anecdote that I've been saving up to give a talk exactly like this. So about a year ago, I was traveling from Canada to the United States on official business, and I was crossing through the border and ran into one of your lovely border protection people who wanted to know who I was and what I was doing and making sure that they weren't letting in any undesirables into your fine nation, and asked me where I was going, and I said, California, and he said, "Who do you work for?" "Federal Government of Canada." "Well, okay, well, what department do you work for?" "Privacy Commissioner of Canada." And there was a beat, at which point he said, "Privacy? That's a weird thing for the government to be doing." No, government. Now, I felt this wasn't really the time or the place to engage deeply in a debate over the role of government and privacy regulation while I was trying to cross the border. But I hope someday maybe the border agent will stumble upon this talk perhaps someday in the future and take it upon himself to broaden his viewpoint and learn a bit more about the importance of the public service in privacy regulation, and particularly in tech policy. But even if he doesn't, I hope all of you will learn a little bit something this morning. But a few disclaimers to begin with. The first is, I'm not a lawyer. I will be touching on some points of the law this morning, but I am really, really not a lawyer. We have some wonderful people in the office who are highly trained lawyers with technical backgrounds. If you have specific legal questions, I can speculate, but I will probably be better off taking said questions back to my people, and I'm very happy to give you perfectly accurate legal answers to your questions. But please do bring them up. I just may not be the right person to answer them. And the second is, well, I often get comments when I say I work for the privacy commissioner, and they say, "It's privacy, so you can't talk about your work. Ha, ha, ha." I get that quite a lot. Now, of course, we're quite the opposite. We're very, very open, very happy to talk. And this is one of the exceptions, is often when there's an open investigation, we have to keep confidentiality for a certain period. So if you ask me, there may be some places where I may have to not answer your question, much to my regret. But I'll certainly let you know if you're treading onto any sensitive areas. Now, you don't have a privacy commissioner in the United States, so for the benefit of the Americans who may be in the audience or other places that don't have a similar, I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of the office I work in so you can get an idea of the role of the office and the kind of work that we do. For those of you who maybe don't know our nation's capital, this photograph here is of a part of our parliament buildings with their lovely neo-Gothic architecture, their gargoyles, and their not-so-neo-Gothic CCTV cameras overlooking the nation's capital up on the left. So our office was founded in 1983. We brought in a Privacy Act, which is the Public Sector Act that controls how the government has to handle personal information of citizens. The role was expanded in 2000. We also have a law for the private sector as well. We're what they call an agent of parliament rather than a department. So we report to the House of Commons and the Senate. If I want to make an analogy for you, it's a bit like the U.S. federal independent agencies. You have the FCC and the FTC and the SEC. It's closest parallel is to that sort of an agency. Our commissioner is Jennifer Stoddart, smiling in the corner of the slide. There are about 170 employees at the office, and we're located in Ottawa, Ontario, the nation's capital. And we have a mandate and we have a mission. Formally, we are here to oversee compliance with the two laws. So we had the Privacy Act that I mentioned, which is the federal legislation from 1983 that sets out rules for how institutions of the federal government have to deal with personal information of individuals. And we have PIPEDA, the Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act, which came in 2000, and that is governs how the private sector organizations collect, use, and disclose personal information in the course of commercial business. So we have a little bit of the public and a bit of the private. But we have a broader mission beyond just compliance. We actually are here to promote and protect privacy rights of individuals. So beyond just the law, we have a very broad mandate for things like outreach, for education, for providing guidance, for supporting research, all these things that don't really fall under legislation, but we feel are really important for just promoting privacy rights across Canada and beyond our own borders and to other other nations as well. We're what they call an ombudsman, really. We are not quite the same regulator as some other places. We tend to mediate more. We act as a mediator between people who have complaints. We've been mandated to act as an ombudsman, an advocate, and a guardian of privacy and the protection of personal information rights. The commissioner has a certain number of powers. They include investigating complaints. So citizens can put forth complaints against the government or against businesses if they feel their privacy rights have been violated in some fashion. We can conduct audits and pursue court actions under the law. We can publicly report on information handling practices. So if something has gone wrong, there may be reports about how that shouldn't have happened and how to correct it in the future. We promote public awareness and understanding of privacy issues, and we supporting undertaking and publishing research into privacy issues. So that may be of interest to the people here in the research community, that we definitely have a tie to research as well. Okay, some numbers. They won't take too long, I swear. Just to give you an idea of the kind of things we do, we take inquiries from the public, so we had over 10,000 of those. People can phone us up and ask us questions about privacy. We handle complaints. We look at legislation. We have a question from the audience. I assure you, we do not record information from our callers. You believe me. Good. I am from the government, and I'm here to help you. More jokes, sorry. We look at policies, initiatives in the private sector and the public sector. We issue guidance and research documents. We sign grants for different contributions, so research initiatives that are going on across Canada. Go to Parliament, quite a number of speeches, a lot of interviews. Our blog and our website get a reasonable number of hits. We are a source of information for a lot of Canadians, but we also find that we get a lot of visitors, a lot of them from California, as it turns out. I think we seem to be a source of guidance and information for our American colleagues as well. And we send out a lot of publications and fact sheets for, again, individuals and business. We're not the only people, of course, in this space. There are other agencies like us in Canada. So there's they're in the provincial level as well as the federal level. So across Canada, similar kind of role. In the United States, a similar role is done at the FTC. There's a division of privacy and identity protection. So it's a bit more focused and it's specifically more about consumer protection issues. But in other countries, they have data protection authorities, over 40 countries of these, predominantly in Europe. So mostly there's going to be something like our office in most of the European nations, often federal, but also state, provincial, sometimes municipal. There's things going on at the EU level, at the OECD. So we're all over the place. But we also want to have a look at what does it mean for IT research. So all of that was to give you the scope of our agency and its role politically. Now, I have used this slide before because I really like the quote that came out of it. This came out in 2009 when Chris Segoyan went to work at the FTC. So he had a very similar job to the one that I do. And it was newsworthy enough anyway to show up in Wired, as you see, to say that outspoken privacy advocate joins FTC. But I like the quote that he gave, and which he talks about the importance of having someone in the regulatory body that understands the technology. So it's someone who can understand the code. It's someone who can do the analysis, who can look at the data flows. Because that's key to understanding the complexities of these issues and doing proper investigations. And you know, he thinks Washington, D.C. would be a better place if there's more geeks. Well, of course, Ottawa, we think, is already a better good place because we have a lot of geeks in it. So we have certainly taken up this call. We've had some people in our office even before Chris started. But this is a good trend that we see more and more DPAs having this technical capability. So we have what we call the technology analysis branch at our office, which is where all the IT folks hang out. And what we do really is we support everybody else. So our role is to take what we know, what we can do, and feed it out to everyone else's requirements. So investigations is a big one, and that's the one that I'm mostly going to be focusing on today. If there's a complaint of some kind that has a technological component, it's going to wind up on one of our desks. We also have an audit and review group, so they will do audits of businesses and they'll do audits of government departments. Also look at privacy impact assessments. So if the government is rolling out a new program that has some kind of privacy implication, it's an e-passport or a biometric initiative, then they're going to be sending something to our office and the technologists are going to be giving it a fairly thorough read. Communications, which I will note, you would be surprised. You looked at the numbers and there's a lot of communications out of the office. Well, the technologists get involved in a lot of that. We'll either be reviewing materials or providing media lines or writing materials to go out on the blog. It is really important to be able to explain complex technical subjects well in our line of work. So for those of you who are good at that and whose papers I have read, I commend you for doing this. It's a very difficult job because we have to do the same thing where we are. Lastly, we work with our lawyers, who I mentioned before, our policy people and our researchers, who are very tightly work, the policy and research work very tightly because they're collecting the information that feeds into the policy. So we like to feed into any technical discussions that they have. So speaking of research, I'm going to note that we do have what they call a contributions program, which is an annual program we run that has grants for privacy research and public education, which is our way of reaching out and making sure that other people who are doing good work in nonprofits and universities are able to carry out their work. We gave out $350,000 this year to 8 projects. I gave a couple of examples there. One was about communications intercept, on about national security issues, and the second is a game for kids, trying to use games to help teach them about privacy. And we have 4 main areas that we tend to concentrate on: national security, identity, integrity and protection, information technology, and genetic privacy, which I will note most of which were touched on by Charlie Strauss in his keynote, so I get the impression we're moving in the right direction, or will be for the next medium-term future, which is good to know. We have a lab, by the way. Now, I took this photograph when we were just unpacking the boxes, which is why it doesn't really look like a real lab covered in stuff. I assure you it's now got more cables and stuff and boxes and things falling on top of other things because we've been using it now. Predominantly, it's used for investigations and to some degree research. So a lot of things going on here with packet analysis, with looking over websites, with doing capturing of websites and looking at default settings and reading privacy policies and trying to fit a little research around the edges. But I think it's nice that we actually have managed to make a lab inside a government department that isn't actually fundamentally a research institute. You know, to summarize all of that, really, we have a lot of tasks. We are here to protect your privacy, and your technologists are working hard to make that happen. And to illustrate that, I have case studies because it only makes sense for you to see some of these things in practice. And so I'm going to pick 2 of the most recent investigations that were really huge that involved technologists the whole way through, which were the Facebook case and the Google Wi-Fi case. And I'm going to talk a bit about how technical expertise was needed to do the analysis and carry these things out properly. So the first one was Facebook, which for our office was the first really major technical investigation we had, which began in 2008. So it's kind of a natural place to start. So this one predated me by a bit. It began before I got there, but hadn't finished by the time I started. So these investigations can go on for quite some time as it happens. So how this began is from a complaint that was filed with us by the Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic, which is called CIPIC. So this is a group at the University of Ottawa out of the law department. They have a very strong tech law program at the University of Ottawa. And what a bunch of law students decided to do was to have a look at Facebook's policies and practices and compare them to what they thought the PIPEDA, the private sector law, said were appropriate practices for collection, use, and disclosure of personal information to see if they were in compliance with the law. And after a lot of analysis, they put together a very wide-reaching complaint that they submitted to our office. They had 24 allegations over 12 different subjects. I've listed some of the subjects there. They looked at the default settings for privacy, how users' information was used for advertising, how it was disclosed to third-party apps, and how non-users' personal information was used. They wrote quite a comprehensive document that they submitted to us, which was going to take up a certain amount of time over the next little while. So in 2008, they filed a complaint, and at this point would be when all the technical investigation would begin. So generally what you have to do is you first have to substantiate what's going on. If someone gives you a complaint that alleges that something is happening, that a company is doing something, that you believe this, you have to actually validate that this is the case. So there's quite a lot of analysis that goes on, which is why we have a lab, of course, in which you try to substantiate the facts of the case. Go through lots of examples, take the role of the user, look at all of the settings, and record the heck out of everything that you do so that you can build the case to show whether or not there's any truth to the allegations that have been put forth. So this involved a lot of review of the website, looking at the features, looking at the defaults, looking over the privacy policies, which can change over time throughout the investigation, but looking at all the data flows. So what's going to the advertisers? What's going to the third-party applications? So there's a lot of packet analysis going on. You know, we have spend lots of time with various Wireshark-type tools, and this is a reason for that, because most of what we're looking at is data flows. It's all about how the information is being disclosed to parties. So after doing a lot of work on the back-end analysis, they came up with the facts of the case, and about a year later, announcement was made that they had identified a number of concerns and that some of them remained unresolved, and they were supposed to respond within 30 days. So we lay out and say, these are the ones that there was no substance, these ones you resolved, these other ones you have to deal with. So they agreed to make a series of changes, and they had a one-year timetable for implementing the changes. So no one expects them to do it in 30 days. You get a time to actually respond, but then you're expected to show that you have made these changes. And then a year later, a review had been completed, the investigation was done, and that they had been resolved. And I'll go back and talk about some of the issues specifically. There were 8 items that had to be resolved in this particular case. Now, 6 of them were mostly about language. So I will point out that not everything that we look at is going to be quite as technical. A lot of it does have to be the actual English language and the way you express things. There's a little bit of the legal side, but it's all about users' expectations. So again, as a usability person, it's interesting to me to see what users interpret and what are their models and what do they think is happening to their data and how well can they understand what's happening. As well as how well can they use the controls to carry out what they want to do. So 6 of these items had to do with making the language clearer and fixing items in the privacy policy. So an example is that if you wanted to delete your account, there was some confusion over deactivation versus deletion. So if you deactivated your account, that just meant that it went dormant. It didn't actually disappear. So if you came back, they would reactivate your account and all the data was still there, which is certainly not the same as deleting your account in which all the data is removed. And there was a lot of confusion over these terms so that users didn't know what they were actually selecting when they made their choices. So this was one of the pieces they had to clean up in the language, which was done. So these were readily resolved. But there were 2 items that were a little more difficult to get a quick solution on. And the first was default privacy settings. And this one tends to be difficult anyway because there are lots of questions about what the appropriate stance is, about whether or not you should be opting in or opting out of particular ways of disclosing information. Do we think this is the kind of thing it's all right to allow people to opt out of? Because we know that many people don't change the default settings. So the choices that you make here are very important. So there's large policy issues here as well as usability and other issues. But they did roll out a lot of changes to provide users with better information and more control. They had these completely change the way that you did your settings. They added this low, medium, high privacy settings and a whole matrix. And they were able to make better adjustments to the default settings that way with these per object controls. So all of these were going on. And then in 2009, there was a complete site redesign. So there's a completely new set of features that rolled out right around that period. There was a lot of news issues about that because people had just thought they figured out what had happened, and then everything changed underneath them, and they couldn't figure out what information had been exposed at this point. So another thing that happened was that certain types of information were now made always public. There was categories that were now 7. There were 7 items were proposed and were scaled back to 4 after some back and forth. So now the 4 items were your name, your profile picture, your gender, and your network. So it does not matter how restrictive you make your settings, these things are always going to be publicly available. So this had changed from the beginning of the investigation to the point that we got into. So the message here actually, well, while the rollback from 7 to 4 was the right kind of direction, we sort of made a statement from the office that the future plans for this category of information made a little uneasy, that this was not a category wanted to see expanded in the future. You know, rollback is good, but really want to control making categories of information public. Third-party applications took a little bit longer. There were a lot of concerns over the safeguards. So these were the games and the quizzes on Facebook, where you would have maybe friends who were signing up for various things and then asking you to sign up so they could also be playing this game with you, whether you wanted to do that or not. And you soon quickly found out who your friends were and who were the really annoying friends, very much because they were the ones who would keep bugging you to play that game you didn't want to keep playing. But there were also concerns about what information they could leak about you. Because if they have access to your profile information and they are very open to a lot of quizzes and games, the question is, can they then pass your information on to some other third party that you don't want to have access to your information? They had hundreds of thousands of developers. There was not a real good sense that there were technological safeguards in place that was going to keep information from leaking across all of these different applications, across parties who didn't want their information being sent to these third parties. And users didn't know what information the applications wanted and what they were accessing and why they needed it. So this was not exactly in keeping with PIPEDA. So after some negotiation, there was a new permissions model which restricted the use to what users agreed to release. So there were pop-ups that said, this application requests the following categories of information, and you had to approve those categories to be used with that application. And the friends were not allowed to just provide apps with your data without your explicit permission. So they couldn't leak your data over into their apps. So if you had a very chatty public friend and you were very private, they couldn't actually override your wishes and hand your information over to Farmville or whoever. And here's a place where the technologist kind of stepped in. So someone on our team made up an app for doing the permissions model. So we were in there making up apps and testing out the data flows to make sure that everything was working the way that we thought. So, you know, actual writing of stuff going on in the office. But of course, moving target. As I mentioned, even partway through, we had this rollout in December of 2009, and there were a lot of features. I mean, Facebook and a lot of other things move fast. So you have a set of allegations at one point, you're doing investigations, and everything is moving underneath you, which makes it really hard to make assessments and recommendations. Sometimes it's great because they've already gotten ahead of you and made the change you would have requested them to do, but other times not so much. And of course, the site then continues to evolve beyond the issues that you brought up in the first place. And right around the time we're wrapping up the first part of Facebook, then there was another set, which at least I can sort of say there were another couple of investigations around the social plugins, the like button, and about invitations that were made to people to join Facebook. And now we're in the category of open investigation, but this is on CBC. There has been some announcement that the investigations exist, which is about as far as I can take it. But the point is, there's always some new feature, and just when you think once you think you were out, they pulled you back in, sort of idea. There's always some new thing, even when you think you've completed one. There's always going to be something else you're going to have to deal with. But you know, enough about Facebook. We can move on to onto Google Wi-Fi, which was another more recent case, but similarly one that was deeply involved with the technologists. So I'm going to roll you back to April 2010. This story begins over in Europe, to go a little bit beyond the borders. So this was during the period where, again, the Street View cars were driving around and picking up just information about what they could see on the streets, all visual information. And the Federal Commissioner for Data Protection was looking into this and what kind of information was being collected as the cars drove around. And there seemed to be a little bit more information going on there than just visual. It seemed to be a lot of Wi-Fi data that was being collected, which was a little surprising considering it was mostly about mapping and what was going on here. So asked a few more questions about what was being collected, and a response came from Google to say, oh, well, we're going to clear this up. We'll tell you what we're collecting and why we're collecting it and what we're doing with it. And the idea was, we're trying to improve our location-based services. So while we're driving the cars around, let's collect some information about the base stations we can see, so we can add this information to our GPS, we can get better triangulation, more accuracy, and we'll just piggyback it on the Street View cars because they're driving around anyway, and that will allow us to pick up this data and we kill two birds with one stone. So the important paragraph in the statement that they made is that the equipment that they had on the cars can receive data, but the payload is discarded, so they never collect the content of any communications. So as privacy authorities, this is the kind of information you want to see. You want to find out what exactly you're collecting. So this is 27th of April. So a little bit later, another data protection supervisor in Germany was looking a little bit deeper into the issue and wanted a bit more information about what was being recorded on the hard drives to get an idea of exactly what was being picked up as they were driving around and collecting Wi-Fi information, and was looking at the vehicles and saw that there was no hard drive and said, well, I want to have a look at the hard drive, but said that the information was encoded and you won't be able to read it. So we'll go have a look at that to give you the information. And then the company went to examine the drive, and then when they went to examine the drive, they found some unexpected material. So back when they said that there wasn't any payload data being collected, there was payload data being collected. So again, they've been prompted to look at it and suddenly found out that they were collecting more data than they intended to. So a little bit of an oops there. So 600 gigs in 30 countries. This was, of course, not limited just to Germany, because this had been rolled out into the cars that had been sent all over the world. There was some experimental code that had been written sometime previously that had been put into the scanning software for Street View, which inadvertently vacuumed up the payload and the header data. So in response to this, they grounded all the Street View cars and segregated out all the data, because now we have a bunch of information here that's likely to be not what we wanted, a little bit more than just information about mapping. And they made, of course, a public announcement to explain what had happened. So they put a notice up on the blog, and I've highlighted the part in red here that they stated it was clear we have been collecting samples of payload data from open Wi-Fi networks, in opposition to what had been said earlier about not collecting the data. They publicly announced that they had done this. Now, they note they didn't use it in any Google products. It was inadvertent, but the point is you've still collected the personal data. So what happened? There was a lot of outrage. There was a lot of news stories. There was a lot of anger. There were a lot of complaints. There were a lot of very angry consumers from all around the world. There were some lawsuits, some of which are still going on, and there were a lot of formal investigations from the various agencies around the world, including one by our office, which is why I brought it up. So in June, we announced that we were going to do an investigation. Thankfully, we were helped along a little bit on the technical side that about a week later, Google had done a third-party software review by Stroess Friedberg, where they released publicly the report where they had looked at the code from top to bottom and showed you what all the components were, did a full analysis. So that really gave us a better idea of what we were dealing with, what we could expect to see from the code, what did we think were going to be collected. So that kind of material, I give them full points for being so upfront and releasing this material, because you really need all the information you can get in this kind of case. Particularly, you have a limited number of resources, you often have a limited amount of time to respond, you're trying to deal with these things quickly. So being forthright, very helpful. If any of you are in a company who ever, please, I hope this never happens to you, but if you're in the situation, being forthright, very, very helpful. It's the better way to go in the long run rather than trying to cover it up, I swear. So about a month later, the couple of the techies, we went down to Mountain View to do a site visit. Along the way, meeting a border patrol agent who had some questions for me. So a few details about the Canadian data, because that's the information that I have. So it was about a year's worth of data that they were collecting for about a year, 18 gigs in Canada, asterisk. The asterisk is there because it isn't exactly quite Canada just because of the border. So it's likely that a bit of Canadian data is in the US and a bit of the American data is in the Canadian data. But for the most part, it's Canadian data. 6 million VSS IDs in the data set, to give you just some idea of the size of it. So the question then is, what do you do about this? So we do have laws. This one would fall under our PIPEDA law, but this is all about personal information, which we call PI. So what we're concerned about is the collection of personal information. Now, one might presume personal information had been collected, but remember, you're supposed to be verifying the facts of what happened. So personal information in the law is about information about an identifiable individual. So it doesn't include business information, so your business contact isn't in that category. It's been exempted in that law. but it will include your residential address. We have ruled that IP addresses can be considered personal information because they can be tied to an individual. The content of your communication, there's many, many categories of personal information. So what we were trying to show is whether or not this had been in the data set. But that gave us a bit of a challenge. So at this point, we have a segregated set of data that we don't really want anyone to be reading because it's personal data. And it may not be that what you want to do is then delve into it and look deeply into the data that you really hope nobody would look at, but yet you're trying to still validate the case. So we came up with our approach to this. We were very careful as to how we just went through our investigation because we didn't want to make it worse by making deep dives into some poor individual who had a lot of information vacuumed up. So what we did, we decided to do was to verify particular types of personal information, and we picked five examples, so we would then stop looking. So a lot was just automated, looking for the type, validating it, and using just the highest level descriptive notes, not taking notes on John Smith of whatever address had, wrote the following email, nothing like that, just there is a name of an identifiable individual and a content of communications, we have an example, because we were just trying to show it existed, and once we had, this was in the data set, we know that it's there. So again, a little bit more, not much coding, but probably the first time that the command line was used in an investigation in the office, we were running a lot of searches on the data. So regular expressions all the way, Perl, this was fairly straightforward, looking for header fields, looking for keywords, looking for specific patterns that we expected would highlight a piece of personal information, and then it was manually verified. But since we were only looking for a few examples, we could do manual verification because you wouldn't really want to rely on just a string match that might end up not being what you thought it was when you're trying to validate the facts of the case. And again, this is all very carefully documented. So very briefly, what we found, of course, lots and lots of headers. So email headers, HTTP. So you're talking about a lot of email addresses, so hence personal information. IP, usernames, URLs, so you can tell where people are browsing. Lots and lots of cookies. So if we, I guess, had FireSheet running around that time, we probably could have decided to use it to steal a bunch of cookies at that period. Lots of contact details, and there were definitely full email messages. Some of the early communications that came out of Google stressed that it was fragments, because of course the car is driving down the street and it's switching channels fairly frequently. But given the speed of the networks and the speed of the car, and you know, it can sometimes be stopped at a stop sign, it's not inconceivable that you can pick up an entire communication, and indeed we did see entire top to bottom email messages from people. So we took all of this and brought it back to the investigators who issued what they call a preliminary letter of findings on October the 19th, and the complaint was determined to be what we call well-founded, so it's substantiated. There's personal information that was collected, and these are the items under the law that make that a violation. So there are some principles that are in the law, which are used here, and there are three of them here. So you talk about knowledge and consent. So we said that the collection of the data was done without the individual's knowledge and consent because, of course, it was inadvertent. So you didn't get anyone's consent before you collected the information and put it into your car. Similarly, you are supposed to identify the purpose for which you are collecting personal information as a business. You are supposed to tell the individual why you are collecting it. Well, again, inadvertent, they didn't have a purpose for collection that was identified to you, so there was strike two. And you are supposed to limit your collection to the purposes identified. So you can't use the data then for another purpose that you haven't described. But again, since there was no identified purpose, you know, strike three. So under the law, this shows that it's in violation. But mostly, I will point out, remember that ombudsman role, it's mostly about the process. It's not really about like pointing at them and taking millions of dollars or anything like that. The idea mostly is about how did this happen? And we want to make sure it doesn't happen again, where it's definitely much more about how we got into this mess and how to not have it happen again more than anything else. And how do we prevent it? And in this case, it was a few errors, really, that led to the epic fail in this case, where you had a piece of code that hadn't gotten the same kind of review. It had been kind of moved from one project to another, kind of bolted on. That's generally not the best way to be doing your privacy. I'm sure all the security people here are sort of looking at that as sort of being the recipe for disaster when you're adding something in for a slightly different purpose. There were some places where it might have been checked if it had been, for example, a more mainline product, where there had been more people checking it along the way with a more formalized process. But again, it was kind of put in on the side and added to the car. So there were places where there were gaps, and it fell right through them. So it only took a few small places to miss for something really bad to happen, unfortunately. So what we did is we issued a set of recommendations. One of them was to do privacy training for staff, because if you are putting in code into something and you may want to recognize that there are some privacy issues from what you're doing, it requires that you actually know something about the privacy implications of what you're doing. So some training would be helpful then to that everyone is a little more responsible, a little more aware. We also wanted more of a governance model, because it was evident from the discussions that we'd had that, again, there were places where this might have been caught had there been a little bit more due diligence and attention been paid. So more controls for detecting the problems and having individuals who are responsible. It's really important for somebody to be the responsible person, and also the person you can come to who is quite knowledgeable about the issues, who will spot these, who will answer your queries, help things to run a bit more smoothly. And we want them to delete the Canadian data, because, well, there was really no use for them holding on to it anymore, certainly. So about 3 days after we issued the report, now this is not the formal response, this is just on the blog. So this is one that turned around really quickly, and an announcement came out where they said, oh, here's some things we're going to do. Well, we're going to do some training. We have some enhanced training on privacy that we're rolling out, and new hires are all going to have mandatory training as of the end of the year. And we're doing some changes in governance and compliance. So the engineering project leader is going to have to do a privacy design document to look at more of these issues, to have them more planned out through along the process, making sure that these same issues don't repeat. And people responsible, well, then Alma Witten was appointed director of privacy for engineering and product management. So interestingly, some of the things they decided to do seem to be in harmony with the things we recommended that they do. So it seems like they were moving in the right general direction. A little bit of an addendum. There was a formal response that came out in June, and the OPC was mainly satisfied with the changes and the changes that were proposed that were being rolled out. So again, they'd already begun to move on this really quickly, but you have to tie these things up formally. But we did add a little bit, which is we requested an independent third-party audit of the programs, because they've now changed their governance, and it's sometimes hard to know whether you've done the right thing or how well are they working. And you want that assessment to say, yeah, we tried out this process, and how well is it working? And you bring in someone independent, and it will say, oh, yes, this is working, or you might want to try adding these steps. And then we want them to tell us what the results are, and then we'll sort of tell how well things are working. I'll just note, this is the first time we've ever asked a company to undergo a third-party audit, so it was sort of unprecedented in this case. So we'll see how this one turns out. So that was the past. I'm going to add we have a question, and I'm going to stop and absolutely. Okay, I wondered if I was going to add, yes, get a question about the data. So the question was, did they delete the data? And I think you asked how quickly. So this ended up being kind of an issue, sometimes because of the timing. So the last set of correspondences we had is that the process is ongoing, mainly because of the American lawsuits that are going on right now. So some of the countries had their data deleted immediately. So it's a very good question. I may as well stop and address this properly. Each of the different nations who had this happen, so there were 30 countries, some of them dealt with it in different ways. So some of them said, just delete the data. You've stated that you're culpable in a sense, and we'll just move on. We'll do whatever we need. We'll do the fine, or we'll just censor you, and they will move on ahead and get rid of the data. Some other people did what we did and held on to the data so that they could do investigations of various kinds that depended. There were some of those in Europe as well as Canada. We're in that unfortunate situation in a sense where we have that mixed data. And what we didn't want to suggest was that if they got rid of that, getting rid of our data would trump any responsibilities for holding on to data that might have been used in evidence for a lawsuit. The difficulty is in teasing out those piles of data as to which ones would be material to a lawsuit of some kind in the United States. So at this stage, it's all signs are moving towards the right direction, but it's that had made it more complicated than if we had just said, blow it away and we don't want to look at it. Does that answer your question? Sorry, could we have deleted the... Oh, we didn't actually take any of the data. We did not make a copy of the data. The data stayed where it was. Nothing moved over the border. It was determined that it was more... We got the information we needed on site, and the risk to making copies or moving the data was more than... There was no need to do that, and the risk would be quite high. So we did not make another copy of the data that we had to get rid of. Yes? We do have a there. Well, so the question was about secure deletion of data. So are there requirements that we have on data deletion? And we do have a lot of guidelines and standards that we've put out from the office about doing deletion of data. This one is a little more complicated with jurisdictional issues and where they're holding the data in terms of doing the verifications. There's every indication that the data is being deleted in the proper, appropriate fashion. And because there's been a lot of communication, and sometimes you sort of have to, I don't want to quite say, don't quite take their word for it, but you ask what processes were put in place in order to delete the data, and that's what you would use. If it's something within our borders, then we have a little bit more ability to go in and validate and look at drives and that sort of thing, if necessary. But you're absolutely right that the secure deletion of data, big issue. And another question.
So the purpose of your investigation, as you mentioned, was to establish these three points that were part of the complaint. But it seems to me that this is something that Google likely stipulated to, at least it seems their blog post directly admitted to all three elements that you were trying to establish. So what was the actual purpose of the investigation?
Well, in this case, it was what they had stated was that in a sense that if there were personal information that had been collected, those three points would have been,
they didn't actually stipulate
the whole thing because, again, you know, in a sense, we established the facts of the case in this particular investigation, and it also gave us the ability, because it wasn't just about the compliance to the law, although that's important, it was also questions around the discussions of how did it happen, as opposed to just necessarily the violation itself. So you get a lot of extra information as a part of the investigation as to the facts and the context of how it happened as well, which gives you some extra data.
Hi. On Facebook, you mentioned toward the end that it was a moving target, so to speak. In that regard, and I don't suppose Facebook is at all unique in constantly changing on the internet. And meanwhile, you've got the CEO popping up every so often, making statements that are taken to be to the effect that your foolish humans, your conventional notions of privacy are obsolete. And he's not unique in making statements in that regard. So the question does this not all suggest that this is a losing game of catch-up for you and for other regulators and for privacy?
Oh, God, you're going to put me out of a job this morning. I'll just give up. I'm just going to go home. No, of course not. And we also have to bear in mind, of course, that we are, of course, going to be taking the privacy stance on all these questions because we're a privacy office. But part of the reason that we're mediators is because there's always another side, and there's always going to be things that are going to balance out these questions. So the businesses have their own interest. Sometimes those come in conflict with privacy. Sometimes they don't. But also, you sometimes have to have a deeper look at some of the rhetoric that happens. And sometimes there is a lot more going on than just a simple, like, privacy is dead and get over it kind of question. We keep a close eye on a lot of the, I guess, reasonable expectations of privacy that are happening in the world as to what people genuinely think is happening with their data. And it's contextual. Lots of work talking about how it's not as simple as just saying things that are in public are all, everything is all at one level and it's publicized forever because it's at one level. So we definitely, from what we have heard, and we also do a lot of public opinion research about this as well for Canadians, would definitely not say that it's something that is sort of dead or a losing battle. It's a challenge, I guess, in the same way that defensive security is a challenge. There always seems to be some kind of a problem to solve, but certainly not something that we feel is a done deal or even a losing battle necessarily.
If I could follow up briefly on Facebook in particular, is there any indication in your office's dealings with Facebook that its strategy is not to press the limits and perhaps accept sanctions as a cost of doing business in the area of its commercial exploitation of users' data and other privacy practices?
Okay, I'll step slightly to, I'll broaden it slightly as opposed to that making that a Facebook question, but that comes up quite a lot. There's always this question of, is it that it's better for you in a sense to ask for forgiveness, you know, rather than getting permission, that if you just put out a feature or roll it out and everyone gets used to it, or maybe you have to roll it back a bit, that it shifts that expectation or that norm where people then get more and more used to putting out a little bit more data. So that's definitely of concern, because it's generally what people want, well, no one is going to stand in their way, but there is definitely a concern that the steps that companies make, the choices that they make, have an effect on society. They have an effect on the choices that people make, what they do, and how they perceive things. So definitely an issue of concern. But I wouldn't necessarily say that's the business model. Part of the reason we have a regulator also is to make sure that everything doesn't become about the business model and not about, you know, the rights of people. Because then we become, in some sense, a buffer against that, where everything is all about whether it works for business or not. Well, then we become something that, you know, requires that you look at some other issues around privacy law, because that's what a regulator in some sense is there for, as a bit of a bulwark against some of these market driven ideas that may then impinge on things like privacy rights. Okay. You know, a lively audience, this is great. Okay, so a couple of current and ongoing issues. Now, there's always more things going on than I could fit even in one talk. I mean, even probably this morning, I read a lot of news, I have a lot of feeds, I have a lot of, the tweet deck is going, there's a lot of stuff to keep on top of. But I'm just speaking to that in the spring were very large news-wise and technology-wise. One of them was location privacy, and probably anyone who was doing anything in that space was familiar with a lot of these stories. This graphic came from a story about a German Green Party a politician who was looking into information that was being collected on mobile devices and wanted to have a sense of what kind of picture you could make given that kind of data. And he decided he was going to publish his own mobile phone data. It was from August 2009 to February 2010. He wanted to say, all right, I'm going to take my data set and then we're going to combine it with the social media information that's available about me and see what we can figure out. As it happened, to even access the information, he had to file suit against Deutsche Telekom in order to get it in the first place. But he was able to get it and then gave it to a newspaper who put together a large visualization. And if you haven't seen the visualization, there's a link on the bottom there where they show the tracking over that period at several places in different cities and events that he went to all tracked on the side. So it gives quite an interesting picture of the kind of information that can be tracked. Now, I will point out that for this particular story, that is the telco. So that's the side of the telecommunications provider data that they have. But there's also the side of what the actual device has, irrespective of the carrier, which was what most of the actual stories in the spring were about. So there were a whole rash of stories about mobile phone tracking. Again, to go back to the Wi-Fi case, the idea of most of this was to improve location services. That you have mobile devices that are collecting information about their location, and Wi-Fi around them to give good accuracy, to improve the maps that they have, really there for the users, collecting a lot of data. But of course, the privacy issues quickly emerge because you're collecting a lot of data about a ubiquitous device carried on a person all the time while they move around. So about the first one that came out was in April of this year with Alistair Allen, Pete Warden, who were at this Weir 2.0. They put together an iPhone tracker tool that did a visualization of the phone moving across. So this is the map on the bottom. So some of this work, I will point out, has been done. It's not like they were the first people to know this information was collected, but they visualized it so well that it's the one that caught everyone's attention. A bit like, I mean, to go back to FireSheep for a moment, you know, it wasn't that wasn't known, but when you have the tool that shows it really quickly, that the journalists in some sense like, and that it's easier to explain and it has that visual pop, that's what gets everyone's attention, which I guess may be a lesson for you, those of you who don't know that. I expect you probably already do, but that's usually what will be the galvanizing, will be the communication of it and the visualizing and the presenting of your data. It makes a huge difference as to whether your message gets received. So they made a tool and that showed how they moved over space over a long period of time. This was months worth of location information. So it's an unencrypted file, this consolidated DB that was collecting location information and storing it on the device. And it would sync. If you were taking your device and syncing it with your desktop, you had another copy of this location information. When you would be looking for location information, then Apple was querying your devices and collecting information about the cell phone towers and building up the database. There was some later information collected under the Wall Street Journal. So if you want to read more about this, the Wall Street Journal is doing a lot of really excellent articles about privacy. And they followed this one from top to bottom. A lot of this work was done by Ashkan Soltani, who found that when users turned off the location services, it was still being tracked anyway. So that's really problematic because then they don't realize that the information is being collected, which is completely in opposition to them having informed consent over the collection and the use and the disclosure of their data. And then location data, which again, very personal about where you've been, and you can then infer again what you're doing and who you're communicating with, which is can be very sensitive. And this was unknown as well to most iPhone users, even if it was possible they might have been able to know. It was obviously not known because the amount of uproar that happened when the story broke. There were a lot of very, very angry and anxious and scared people out there from consumers when the news broke. Also, there were some stories that this file was being used by law enforcement, just to add a wrinkle to it, that they knew this file was here, and so it had been being used in law enforcement to be able to tell where people were and what they were doing. So there's an extra piece to be concerned about. For some reason, I've lost my pointer. Apologies, I'm just going to. I swear. I'm going to have to jump ahead, am I not? Oh, sorry about that. I'm just going to flick through because it wouldn't. Yeah, a quick review for those of you who want to read at 100 miles an hour. Yes. I don't know why it popped out, but that's okay. So, of course, it's not just Apple who were doing this, so I don't want to point the finger just at Apple. There was Android, of course, they added more stories about that, similar kind of approach. So the data was being collected every few seconds and sent to Google several times per hour. So that's your GPS coordinates, the access points, the signal strength, the network name, and a device ID. So, of course, you've got this trackable device ID. But in this case, the users could successfully turn off the location services. So even though it was similar, there was a little bit of a difference. They were calling this location gate for some period there because it seemed to be one after the other. And we have another question.
Turning off the sending it to Google but still using it for themselves, or just turning off everything?
Yeah, that one, if you wanted to turn off everything, you could definitely turn that one off. I do not recall whether you can collect locally and then not have it be sent.
I want to see my map working, but I don't want to tell Google where I'm going. Was that possible?
I would have to check that one for you. I don't remember off the top of my head. I know you could definitely opt out of the whole thing, but I don't recall if the granular or if the option was such that you could do it. Oh, opting out of the location services, yes.
And it's always easy to opt out of the whole service, and that is not really a solution from the privacy viewpoint. What you want is something where you get the service, but you don't tell Big Brother what you're doing.
Right.
Was that possible?
Yeah, which is I would have to check for you to see whether that was one of the options that was available. I do recall you could opt out, but the degree to which you had to turn it off is the part that I don't recall. I will have to find that out and get back to you on that one. Microsoft also, just to add another person. Another company to the list. Again, when the location services were on, then they would transmit to Microsoft. Again, a unique ID, the Wi-Fi, and the GPS. But it wasn't stored on the device to the same degree. So the Apple had this month's worth of location data that was going on. Not so much with this one. And also, we'll note that they stated that in the fall, they're going to stop putting the device identifiers in. So they're going to take out one of the pieces that can be used to track and remove it. So that, you know, some improvement in the amount of data that's being sent. So there was a lot of political response to this. This was a broad issue with massive repercussions, probably because there were so many mobile phone users. And so it just affected a broad number of people, a lot of major corporations. There were some lawsuits that were launched as well at the time. There's a judicial hearing as well in May There's a subcommittee on privacy, technology, and the law who brought in representatives from many of the major companies that were mentioned here, and a few also technologists to talk about these issues. Because I guess it was mostly Franken, who was chairing the committee, was very interested in this issue. And since then, has with Richard Blumenthal introduced a Location Privacy Protection Act of 2011, which, among other things, is looking towards being sure that users have the informed consent about the collection and the disclosure of the information when they're using location services. There's some other things in the bill as well, but this idea that people didn't know what was being collected and how it was being disclosed was a really key part of the bill. Because you have to remember, of course, that it's different in Canada because we have this very broad legislation that we can use that says we're looking at collection, use, and disclosure, and it's across the board, but there isn't really a parallel in the United States. So sometimes you have to do legislation in specific cases to cover off the lack of a federal level bill. So lawful intercept was another one that came up just recently. Oh, we have another question.
So I'm asking you, because of your position in Canadian government, although it has nothing to do with Canada, so you may just give an answer for, how to say, from similar things, although it would not be holding you to this. For example, just as I came here from the United Kingdom, there were all these riots in London, and then it's alleged that the BlackBerry was used for doing all this. And so obviously the people in government, I mean in other part of government, would be very happy to see inside the BlackBerry where the location of these people that they don't like because they took part in these riots are and so on. So do you ever get any pressure from other parts of government to say, actually, we do want to have the location of these things. At least we want to be able to inspect in case of trouble and stuff like that.
Well, so anything that where a government agency is going to be involved, so we have some oversight on government agencies that are going to be collecting information, so we do get to play that particular role. So there is dialogue that can happen between us and a department who is wishing to collect that sort of information. I will point out that we don't legislate, so if, for example, at some point a government body wanted to introduce a law that would make that kind of collection possible, we would be in a position to make statements about our concerns, but up to the point of the Constitution, that's kind of where the water's edge is on that one, where we would make statements, you know, laying out what the risks were and what our statement would be, but it's still up to the legislature to be able to pass that kind of a law. So we're kind of in that in-between space where we don't actually draft the laws, but we get to guide and make statements and advise in our best capacity. So yes, we keep an eye on the collection and that is happening in the other agencies and departments that are collecting information about people, for sure. It's part of our mandate. I wouldn't characterize the conversations as having a lot of pressure in that sense, because it's not really that kind. I wouldn't say our relationship is quite that way. That we don't have to necessarily back off from pressure from one side or another. Each of us have our own, in a sense, our mandates, and we sort of come under the law to some kind of arrangement, but there isn't really a back-off kind of requirement. We're able to have discussions without feeling that we're sort of being pressured to step back further than our mandate allows. So I hope that sets you a little bit at ease, which I suppose would then move me into lawful intercept, speaking of not really the best opener for that. So I'm going to give you the short history on the Canadian perspective. I know there's a lot of American background on this, but again, I'm happy to have people who are American point out all of what's going on with sort of various digital due process and CLIA type things, but mostly I just know the Canadian context, which is fairly recent. So we have bills around, so it's called lawful access sometimes or lawful intercept. It just tends to be law enforcement agencies who are trying to collect information about communications, so telephone communications, internet communications, which can be signaling, who's talking to whom, as well as content of communications. That's really what we're talking about here. We've had some bills going around for some years that didn't actually pass. So the internet service providers were going to be asked, for example, to do a sort of CLIA type. You had to be able to allow the law enforcement to easily do intercepts on your equipment. These type of bills have been floating around. So 2005 had one of these, which they call the Modernization of Investigative Techniques Act. didn't really get too far. Then it got reintroduced in 2007, private members bill. Those rarely get in, and this was no exception. And then it went quiet, and 2009, they were put into another set. So they made a suite of three, put them in different places, and made another set. So there was C50, Improving Access to Investigative Tools for Serious Crimes Act. So this was expanding current provisions for obtaining warrants for intercept of communications, for tracking, and for telephone number recorders. So again, improving ability to do these types of recording was bill number one. The second one, Investigative Powers for the 21st Century. Again, amending existing legislation, among other things. Preservation demands for communication. So what that means really is you have to hold on to data. So if you're an ISP and you have information, you have communications, you have email, you have something that a customer has, you are now being required to hold on to it should it be used. So currently, that's not a requirement. Sometimes they do hold on to information, but it's not mandated by law. This would mean if you're given a preservation demand, for a maximum of 21 days, you'd have to retain the data on a specific subscriber, I will note. It is not on everybody. It's not holding everyone's data for 21 days. But also, there's no warrant required. It's a preservation demand, is not a warrant. A peace officer can do this, and a peace officer doesn't have to be a cop. There's lots of sort of delegated authorities that are done, where someone is acting in a authoritative capacity to ask for this information. And it's reasonable grounds to suspect, not reasonable grounds to believe. So reasonable grounds to believe, generally you need more of a reason. Reasonable grounds to suspect is a little bit lower. So again, the level at which this data can be preserved is without a warrant. So this one had some privacy concerns. C52 is the CALEA type bill. So this one was the telcos have to make them intercept capable. So you have to set up your equipment to facilitate the intercept of communications. And it's both transmission and content of communications. And so it compels them to provide access to data about the subscribers. So your phone number, the serial numbers, the numbers in the phone, address information, without a warrant under certain circumstances. So again, concerns about not having a warrant, no judicial oversight. So these were being discussed in the spring. This seemed to have a lot of things going on in the spring. So March the 9th, the Canadian privacy commissioners got together and drafted a letter outlining the concerns over privacy risks and sent them to the Deputy Minister of Public Safety in Canada. Again, that's the agency who has the most interest in these types of bills. And also we had a couple of committees who were also reviewing it. So it was the House of Commons Standing Committee on Public Safety and Justice and Human Rights as well. And we have a question from Sandy. Or no, question from the back.
Hello. I'm just curious about the data that has to be preserved. Do you preserve the text messages and the voicemails that people delete from their account?
So it's any data that they would have, in a sense, access to. So if there's a backup or a copy that is under their control, that information is stored. So if it's something on your device, it's on your device. But if it's in their hands, then it becomes something that they are expected to retain. So if there's a duplicate on a server and you have a copy of one thing and you delete it, it's not necessarily deleted for the purposes of the retention order on the other side. So the big concerns, really, absence of the limits on the access powers. A lot of concern about, again, warrant judicial oversight. You sort of want to be able to have this idea that someone is looking a bit carefully when you're collecting information. This is highly personal information. A lot of information required to be collected. You're talking content of communications. You're talking about who's communicating with who, all the contact information across a wide variety of devices. And we're looking at all these mobile phones and a lot of information collected there. And it may be provided without a warrant in some circumstances. And internal controls as well. So there was meant to be some degree of oversight here. So again, a bit of a lowering in some ways of the warrant requirements, but there was supposed to be a lot of oversight. But it wasn't necessarily clear from the legislation that that was going to be reasonable, that the people who were supposed to do the oversight would be able to interface with law enforcement in a way that would be reasonable. So what happened? Well, there was an election. So that changes everything. So the bills had not passed at this point, and as I expect you all well know, that means they sort of die in the order paper, they get scrambled up, they get thrown back, and they have to get booted to the beginning and have to start all over again. In the election, there was a conservative majority government elected as well, just if you were curious as to what happened, if you weren't paying attention. So that's what happened at the end of the election. And Parliament's not in session right now. So it's adjourned until September. They kind of came in for a bit, and then they adjourned for the summer. But the discussion continues, because what is going to happen with these bills? So earlier this week, there was a group called Open Media, who are a sort of digital rights advocacy group, kind of a consumer watchdog sort of group, who issued a statement about an omnibus crime bill. So there's been a lot of discussion that what is going to happen in the fall is that a lot of the bills that didn't pass that are around crime are going to be rolled together and passed in an omnibus. And the question is lawful intercept, the three bills, going to be rolled in? And the concern that this group has, of course, that they aren't going to get the same degree of review and careful consideration one might like if they're rolled into an omnibus that will just pass fairly quickly when they're put in with things around mandatory minimum sentencing and these sort of things, but just going in as a rider. They have requested very strongly that these bills not be included in the omnibus bill. Now, so currently there is no bill. The legislation is not—it's not up yet. It's not formalized. It hasn't been presented. None of this. So all of this, at this point, is speculation. So this is now why the advocacy groups are putting in their, I guess, requests, trying to head some of this off before they get going. Yes.
I have a sort of a low-level question about that reasonable grounds to suspect. Is that reasonable grounds to suspect that this individual is involved in a known criminal activity? Or is it reasonable grounds to suspect that there is criminal activity going on?
Okay, so I'll put on the not-a-lawyer hat, and I believe it is the former rather than the latter. It's supposed to be in a particular investigation that is ongoing, as opposed to using it more broadly to say there's some kind of activity going on. So again, they've put this out earlier this week. You know, they're hoping that we'll see what happens. Again, it's very much a wait and see. And while we were keeping an eye on this side, apparently not that long ago, you guys down here had some kind of an ISP data retention bill that happened. But this was a bit broader. This was in committee, of course. This was passed in committee. This is not something that's gone very far right now, but it's, again, once it's in committee, that means that there's something happening. It'd be keeping logs for 1 year in case of review. So in some sense, it was similar to the preservation demands that I was talking about, only they're broader because they're not, so far as I can tell from reading the bill, and I'm happy to have someone American here correct me, that it's much broader. It's across the whole customer base of holding on to information for longer periods. We keep an eye on what's happening in the States. I often find we are moving in similar directions around the same time. So always keep a little bit of an eye on what's happening in other countries, and we certainly keep an eye on you. because sometimes as America goeth, we like to kind of, and we're interested too, some of the arguments. You've got really good advocates here, and often the arguments that are put forth are applicable to our own country as well. So we sort of appreciate a lot of the advocacy work that's done here, particularly in the technical community. So, you know, it kind of balances out in some ways. But again, the where do we go from here bit, I'm just going to close with a really few remarks on how security practitioners and researchers influence policy from what I've seen on my side. So a little bit about what good, great, wonderful things you do for the government, even if you don't realize it. The work that comes out of the conferences can and does influence policy. You might not see it all the time, but it actually does. The evidence that comes out of the research is vital for informing policy debate. If you have evidence, if you have user studies, if you have metrics and measurements and demonstrable evidence, it's great. It's something that gets used in the policy debates to demonstrate what's actually happening rather than speculating from a position of ignorance. So it's key information. As a technologist, we can't get enough of this stuff. There are many of us reading your materials. So they are making their way into the government. We're happy to disseminate them and make them more widely known. For those people who are writing things, writing clearly and accessibly, really key skill, as I mentioned, about that visualizing, that it really grabs the attention of the policymakers when you can write something that they understand, when you can visualize it, really, really important skill. So there are some of me in the civil service, but we're not really what I call the majority. So if you can be like me and help bridge that gap a little bit, all of that's much appreciated, because then it reaches the people who need to hear it. Rather than just reaching the community here in a sense who already know it. if you have tools to empower the citizenry, that is really valuable. That doesn't often happen within the government. We do a lot of policy work, but we don't often do a lot of the tool development. So I always think Tor is a great success story. This was a great tool for anonymous communication that we've seen how practical, on the ground, useful this has been. So anything at that level is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful work. And that's a huge gap that, again, we tend not to do that. The research and research community does incredibly well, and the practitioner community. If you are of a political type bent, a policy bent, being willing to engage with this messy, messy world of politics and policy can be very rewarding. It's not as neat and clean as some of the technical materials can be on occasion when they work, but it can be worth the pain. There's a lot of paperwork, but there are a lot of payoffs. As a person who works in there, it's a great job. It's something that I care deeply about privacy, something I'm passionate about, and you get to come in every day and feel like you did a little bit of good, which is a wonderful thing to carry around with you. And other benefits, sometimes you get to talk to a room full of people about a subject you're passionate about, so I definitely appreciate that. And for giving me that opportunity, I would just like to say thank you.
Any questions?
Hi, thanks so much for your talk. I have a question. It's wonderful that the Canadian government, you know, is so interested in the privacy of their citizens. Clearly in the US, we don't really have a government advocate for that. The two reasons, you know, that government kind of wants to cross that line would be, you know, law enforcement and public safety. So clearly your law enforcement is really, you know, trying to cross that line or define the line for privacy, but in your opinion, how does the Canadian government handle the public safety and security aspect without violating the privacy of their citizens?
Well, that's one of the harder issues that we grapple with. In some sense, because there are other departments that have that as their mandate, that we, in a sense, we come at it from two different perspectives. But we, you know, national security issues are one of our top priority areas, or public safety issues, because of the complexity of this issue. We do have a document, in fact, if you actually wanted to read about it. We commissioned some research on that from people who have this, who have a background in looking at issues around civil liberties and the balance between civil liberties and public safety, to lay out sort of arguments about where these points of tension are and how to deal with them. So I really wish I could give you a nice soundbite answer. I can really say that it's definitely an issue of deep debate. And not necessarily easily resolved, but the fact that we continue to have the debate, I think, is fairly healthy. It seems to be something that our nation is comfortable having a debate over. It may be that we have the luxury or a difference in the culture, but we seem to be all right in having the debate. I don't always know whether it comes out in the way that either side is comfortable with, but the debate has been, for the most part, fairly informed, definitely spirited and passionate. I'm actually fairly happy with the ability to have that kind of debate without feeling like you have to give up before you start, because you're never going to win.
Thanks again for that talk. So I wanted to ask about whether you've been keeping tabs on the News Corp phone hacking scandal, and how has that affected Canadian citizens, and, you know, what have you been doing to address that?
Okay, so been keeping an eye on, yes. So I could hardly help but keep an eye on it. I don't have a specific kind of initiative or anything I can point you to, but yes, anything that would involve, the collection of, or the hacking of the phones, we get quite a lot of discussion going around. I have a colleague who is deeply interested in a lot of surveillance issues, who sends me much information every day about stuff he's picked up off the newswire. So, you know, I don't have a particular initiative, but I can assure you, definitely something more than high on the radar of the office and the office technologists as well.
Adam Drew from Qualcomm. Thank you for your talk. In the past, I think data clearly, or information clearly, fell into public and private domains, and there was just two spaces, and it was, I think, quite easy for the legal system to sort of identify what it was and then sort of how to proceed. You know, as we go forward, data is falling into this sort of gray area where little bits of data go out there, but it's sort of being put together and aggregated, and so there's sort of this gray zone of data you didn't really intend to leak. It's sort of public, but not really. How do you think the privacy debate or the privacy, how are we going to sort of resolve that issue of data leakage and somebody sort of putting it all together and then eventually revealing quite private things about you for data that was somewhat public? That's my question.
So again, I'm loving the questions, but that one is one, again, you're hitting a lot of the really difficult issues. And this public-private divide has been something that we have had a lot of policy debates. And in fact, we again have had sort of at least one discussion of experts who came in to do public talks about this idea, about what it means, in a sense, to be private in public. And the fact that there isn't that clean divide, that there are things that even were once public that no longer should be, or there are things that are quasi-public, or items that are independently public that together are pulled to make, as you said, you aggregate them and suddenly something becomes a lot more personal. Now, legislatively, the way we've tried to deal with some of these is by trying to be quite broad and trying to be really principle-based and trying to be a bit flexible in how we interpret we are able to deal with some of these contextual issues because the legislation is broad. But you pick the word gray zone, and that's the issue that we have, because when you have a very broad principle-based legislation, it means there's gray areas because there's interpretation that happens. So on the upside, it allows us to have that ability to deal with these more complex issues where it's not just simply, yes, this is public, no, it is not. But it all comes down to the interpretation. And so someone has to be in that position to do those sort of reasoned interpretations. There are a lot of scholars looking at some of these issues. There's good work that comes out of the things like the Privacy Law Scholars Conference, where a lot of, scholars in this area will do sort of early draft papers that then come out to things like the law review. And there are people who are talking about how to apply some of these ideas into the law. So I'm confident to some degree that some of this will work its way through, particularly in the American context, and maybe we can borrow from some of their legal scholars. But not the world's easiest issue to resolve, and I think that one may also be a moving target to some degree as with sociological changes. Maybe not really answering your question so much as adding more questions to your stack, but I think you've put your finger on one of the more difficult public-private issues.
Hi, my name's Carson Gasper. I work for Dollar Bank. So my question is, we've had some laws over the past 10 years of dubious efficacy, like Sarbanes-Oxley and HIPAA. Are there equivalent specific laws in Canada, or are they just all falling under the general broad, principle-based law you were talking about?
Okay, so yes, thank you for that one. This one I can at least get a bit closer to with my not legal hat on. No, there are definitely other sector-specific laws as well. So particularly for things like health, because health is not a federal jurisdictional, it's a provincial jurisdictional issue. We have a PHIPAA in the way that you have a HIPAA. So we have a nice kind of broad one that covers off, but we also have sector-specific. They just tend not to be only sector-specific legislation, so there's a combination of the two.
Ed Gould, unaffiliated. And I also want to thank Lou Katz for kind of prompting this question, although it's my question, not exactly his. What role would you like to see an organization like USENIX play in contributing to and informing the public policy debate that you are directly involved in?
Okay. So I can actually commend USENIX already for a lot of the work that it does. Particularly, I find that a lot of the, between invited talks and the types of papers that they give, have been very supportive of policy type issues. This is a conference where I find a lot of the people who are interested in policy, in politics. They publish here, they come here, they bounce ideas off each other. They're very engaged, and this community has been very welcoming of that. So I can already sort of commend USENIX for doing that kind of work. Definitely, every time I come here, and I've been coming for quite some time, there is always some talk or piece of research that's directly applicable to some policy issue. And somehow the community has formed around policy people, not as much as some other ones, but they're generally more policy conferences. It's a technical conference that attracts more than its fair share of policy people. And, I would just say do more of that in a sense, but you have to strike a balance. It's not just a policy conference. But I'm very appreciative of the fact they've been so supportive of the policy talks. And bringing in policy people and applying, because it's an applied conference, and they're applying it to policy.
Joss Wright, University of Oxford. Whenever I come to the US, I often end up whining a little bit that it's very US-centric here. But I'm finding myself guilty of the same thing to some extent, because I know a little bit about the US law on things like this, and I don't know a lot about the Canadian law. I just had a quick Wikipedia of Pipeda. And one of the things I noticed was that it comments there that it was brought in to reassure the European data protection authorities that the Canadian law was in line with European data protection, which obviously the US law isn't, which is why we have things like Safe Harbor. And I'm just interested, to some extent, did that work? Is it currently considered adequate? From one person who doesn't wear a lawyer's hat to another.
Yes, as again, I'm not wearing a... Okay, I'm also not wearing the lawyer's hat either. I tend not to be in that side, so again, this is going to be mere speculation. It seems to have worked fairly well. The Canadian stance, sort of vis-a-vis the other kind of DPAs and between the states, we do tend to be seen as the compromise position. We're sort of seen as the Goldilocks kind of, the not too regulated, not too non-regulated. We're somewhere in between the two, which apparently has worked for us fairly well. We seem to have fairly good working relationships with the DPAs in Europe, and so I believe it has worked reasonably well in terms of being a demonstration of a law that is in compliance. I'm not sure if there are some places where it breaks, which is where, again, if I had the legal hat, I'd be able to fling that out at you. But, you know, my perception is that it has worked quite well as a compromise that has satisfied the Europeans as well as Canadians.
Okay, and as a sort of slight follow-up question, I was interested to see the little discussion on personal information and personal data, which is obviously something that is very clearly defined within the European legislative frameworks. But also is a source of great confusion, particularly for research projects and things like that. And I was wondering that within the framework of Canadian research projects, do you have advice or involvement with their research projects to advise them on what the law is and what personal data, personal information might actually comprise?
Okay, and you're not going to the panel this evening all about research ethics and privacy, which I will be on. The way that these work mostly in Canada is because most of the, for example, research bodies work under granting agencies. We have this tri-council body that has a whole set of guidelines around research ethics, mm-hmm. Which lay out a lot of the principles and guidelines and interpretations, and they talk to a lot of the government agencies about that, and they've just, for example, they just did a redraft of that, mm-hmm. and we are one of the agencies who was giving them feedback on how they were making those definitions, because they are in a kind of high-level document. But, you know, we also generally tend to be a source of guidance. We did, in a sense, our best guidance in that document, which is the one that is the guideline for the researchers around how they make their interpretations.
Okay, it wasn't really specifically about ethics, because particularly in my experience, within the European framework calls, it tends to be largely based around medical ethics. You know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of ethical work, but I was more interested in the legislative side, because what we found with a number of European projects is that they have a very intuitive grasp of what personal data is, which doesn't match the legislation in any way. And I was just wondering if whether you get directly involved with projects as opposed to advising the bodies that give money to projects.
Yeah, no, it's actually both. Okay. Yeah, we'll do both. So it'll be large scale because it's in some sense more efficient. But we will certainly talk about specific projects or specific organizations on particular issues. You know, to the best of our ability, we're quite flexible on that front.
So my name is Matthias Barks, Technical University in Munich. I was wondering, is there a Canadian position about American companies giving private data protected by local laws to the U.S. agencies forced by the Patriot Act?
Okay, so Patriot Act material. So there's been there are a lot of kind of stances and interpretations around cross-border data flow, which is a very, very complicated. I'm moving into the legal waters very, very quickly. But yes, it's not something that we've sort of precluded, but it tends to fall into the category of giving disclosure about the types of data. So when someone is going to be giving data over to a place that is subject to the Patriot Act, there are certainly requirements about, in a sense, full disclosure. The person's giving informed consent that they know that this data is something that can be transferred from one point to another. And there are guidelines around, transporter data flows to other countries. But the big thing in this case is, you know, we certainly understand that the Patriot Act exists, And we expect that people who are subject to this are in full communication with the people whose data they're collecting about how they're disclosing it.
Hi, Tara. It's Terrell Taylor from UNC. I just had a quick question about the Facebook and the Google situations. Are you finding that a lot of these companies are they just changing their policies for Canada, or are they doing it across for so I guess how much is the Privacy Commission sort of affecting these companies and influencing them to change their policies on a broader view as opposed to just doing it to placate Canada?
I am very glad you asked. It turns out that quite a lot of the time the changes that we ask for get rolled out kind of broadly. So the ones that happened in the original Facebook ended up being rolled out. They don't just get rolled out in Canada, they get rolled out. And sometimes it may just be because it's easier to do. Sometimes it's because it works really well. It may as well make that change across the board. But yes, often it's not just something that happens in Canada. So something that we decide or we determine is an issue. Of course, you know, if obviously it's an issue with someone else, they get to override. But if we say, you know, why don't you do this in a bit more privacy-friendly fashion, then it spreads. And we had certainly had people who were in the States who said, well, we were really glad that you put in these requirements because then I got a set of features that I didn't have the ability to ask for because we don't have a privacy commissioner that I can submit a complaint to. But then I got this, in a sense, because you guys brought it in, then I got to benefit from the Canadian experience.
And how much influence, though, do you have on a company that doesn't have any servers, let's say, within Canada?
So there is a jurisdictional issue, not putting on lawyer hat again, which talks about substantive presence. There are always questions about jurisdiction when it is something, a company that is, for example, a Facebook that is American-based, that has a large number of Canadian customers. A determination has to be made as to whether or not we have jurisdiction, which is something that goes through the lawyers. And was very carefully done in these cases to make sure that everyone is in agreement. That is jurisdictional issues, very, very big. And it isn't always necessarily about servers. There's different things about whether you have an office, and there are many, many factors that go into it. But yes, jurisdiction, big thing. So if there's something that doesn't have substantive presence in Canada, then unfortunately it ends up being something that's out of our hands.
One last question. With the Privacy Commission in Canada, how has that affected other countries? Have other countries sort of tried to follow suit in terms of setting up these things?
Well, many of these countries have had offices like ours, for some time. Globally, there is a lot of cooperation often between the agencies, particularly when there are issues like the Google Wi-Fi that hit so many countries. You could see that you would be reading who did what and paying attention to what came out in different countries. They have conferences where a lot of the people meet. There was a Google Buzz issue where 10 of the DPAs all signed a statement about sort of the rollout not having been done in a very privacy-friendly fashion, where they all got together and said, yes, we have all these agreements in principle. So, yes, overall, we sort of tend to be a very oddly cohesive bunch across the board.
All right. Thank you.
Can I ask the last question because we're almost out of time? Something that you said earlier when you were talking about the Google Wi-Fi, it seems to me, and I hope I'm getting the sequence correct, that you presented the problems that you were having to Google to them, and they actually did the right thing. They did a complete mea culpa. And then all hell broke loose. And then everyone took offense at this. Am I correct in that? And how do you think that's going to affect other companies actually acknowledging and recognizing that they're causing privacy violations?
Okay, so, well, it depended on when you said all hell broke loose, because there are some. It kind of depends on a lot of things as to whether the company came first or whether someone else. Because sometimes things can leak ahead of when a company decides to admit that they've done something. A lot of it comes down to the corporate stance toward these things. It's true that I think they had to deal with a lot of problems, but the sense I got was they took a lot of heat for that. But there was a lot more appreciation for how forthright they were about describing the problem. So that, I think, went a long way towards, in a sense, healing things and giving them some credibility that when they tried to solve the problems, that they seemed like they were legitimately trying to solve the problem because they were willing to admit their mistake. It gave you more confidence that then they were willing to actually make the corrections because they weren't hiding anything.
Do you see other companies following their example or going the opposite way?
I would hesitate to say whether I see them one way or the other. Right. You have to understand we kind of see people sometimes at an interesting stage. So either you get the people who are very privacy, who are trying to do things right and are talking really early and are great, or the people when something has gone completely wrong. And yes, it's two very different kinds of categories. So I wouldn't want to speculate. I really hope that we're having more of the people, you know, admitting when they have a problem, because then that's the only way that we can fix it.
Thank you, Tara, for a wonderful, informative, and quite interesting discussion. Let us thank the speaker. I think we're out of time. Maybe we can take the rest of the time.